Good day to you. Welcome to another edition of The Front Page. I'm your host, Chuck Meraz. Today we're joined by Mandy Roberts, who is a social service clinician for the state of Kentucky. We'll be talking about the ability of people out there to become foster parents or adoptive parents. And first of all, Mandy, thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chuck. I really appreciate it. I've been working for the state for almost 13 years, and we are really in need of some foster parents in this area. We cover a 15-county region that's the eastern and northern part of Kentucky, and we're really trying to get the word out that foster parents are greatly needed, what it takes to be a foster parent, and just how to become a foster parent. So I'm really pleased to be here with you today.
How critical is the need right now for foster and adoptive parents?
The need is very critical right now. Our last numbers from the month of March, statewide, we have nearly 8,000 children in foster care. That's a significant jump over the last year. And in our region, as I said, which covers 15 counties, we usually have about 700 children. And so it's a struggle each time I get a call from a worker needing placement to try to find a home, especially a home that could accommodate more than one child. So if we have a sibling group of two, three, or four, it becomes really difficult. And we are at times making that decision to have to split these siblings up.
And I was going to ask you about that, if you had to split them up sometimes.
Yes, and that's so difficult on these children to be separated from their siblings, to not know what's going on. You know, that's a comfort to them when they can be together. The support that they have built in as a sibling group, it's so hard for us as workers to have to consider separating them and putting them in different homes.
When you talk about the shortage we're facing right now in finding foster and adoptive parents, how does it compare perhaps with years past? Is it more critical than it was or has been, or?
It absolutely is more critical. We have seen a large increase in the number of children in foster care. We had a meeting just this morning and talking statewide. You know, we talked about the region in Louisville area, and of course they're a lot larger area than here, but they're looking at the difference between typically 3,000 investigations a month. Now they're looking at 3,500 a month. So the numbers are just increasing dramatically. And not all of those calls obviously result in a child coming into foster care, but we do see more and more children each day coming into care, and it's become quite a struggle to find a home for them.
Why is the number of kids rising, perhaps, that need this type of assistance?
Unfortunately, in a lot of our areas, both rural and in some of our cities, we're seeing a large increase in the drug issue. Substance abuse issues have just really exploded across our area. And so we end up with a lot of children who whose parents are abusing substances, and therefore the children become neglected. You know, they're not able to be cared for. So we have to step in and protect those children in that situation.
Why do you think it's more parents or more people are not becoming, say, foster or adoptive parents?
It's hard to say. I think part of it is just not knowing what it takes to be a foster parent. I've always been one that says you don't have to be rich to be a foster parent. You don't have to be anything other than someone who's willing to love and to open their home. You know, these kids, you know, they're just kids. I know there's sometimes a stigma out there. Well, if it's a foster child, they've been in trouble or they've done something wrong. And that's just not true. Yes, these children have experienced trauma. And so they may have some behaviors or some needs that would go beyond our own birth children. But these are children that truly just need someone to be in their corner, to be on their side, someone who's not going to give up on them, who they can count on to be home at 4:30, to be, you know, there in the morning to get them up for school. It's not that they need extraordinary things necessarily, but they certainly could use the ordinary things of a parent who truly is someone who's stable and supportive, consistent, someone they can count on.
Are there some other misconceptions out there you feel need to be cleared up?
I think that's probably the biggest one, is that these are bad kids, and that is just not the truth at all. I think sometimes people feel like maybe foster parents do this for the money, or they do this for other reasons, and that's not the truth either. I work, obviously, like I said, for almost 13 years with foster parents, and I can tell you that my foster parents are some of the kindest, most loving people out there, who truly just want to be able to help these kids in their time of need. One of the big things is also, you know, as the state, our first goal is to return children home. So we're not just working with these children. We are asking foster parents to work with the birth families as well. And that can be a challenge at times, and we recognize that. And in our training, we address those issues, that sometimes it is difficult to work with some of these birth parents. But we truly feel like, for the child's best interest, if we are willing to come alongside that birth family, if they see us working with mom or dad, not working against them, not saying negative things about them, then they just tend to feel more cared for, more loved. Unfortunately, children, you know, if you talk about a birth parent being a problem, or not doing what they're supposed to do, then that reflects on those children, and they start to feel badly about themselves. But if a foster parent is willing to work with that birth family as a whole and support them, we have a lot of families that we work with that just don't have the support themselves. We have birth parents that are young. They don't have parents that have supported them. Some of them have been in the foster care system, and they don't have that, you know, mom to call in the middle of the night, the baby's sick and I don't know what to do. They don't have that built-in support. And so if our foster parents can help be that support for them, we've seen a lot of success that way.
Yeah, I'm sure that you have people who will say, though, to you, okay, I'm interested in becoming, say, a foster parent, but what happens if I wind up with a kid that might just be too much for me?
And we have had those situations, and it does happen. Our policy with the state is we ask foster parents, if at all possible, if this is not a child that's a danger to themselves or somebody else, it's just not working out, to give us at least a 2-week notice to find another home. However, if we do have a child that comes in and they are a danger to themselves or somebody else, we do have several crisis units that are available to us, and we can come and get that child and get them somewhere safe. I mean, that's the most important thing. We want everyone to be safe, whether it's the foster parent, their birth children, other foster children in the home. We don't want to put anybody in danger. So we, you know, every worker gives out their, you know, contact information, who you get a hold of, even in the middle of the night. I've gotten many of those calls in the middle of the night with a foster parent, even just taking a child to the ER. And so I've gotten many of those calls, and that's just part of our job. So we are there to support foster parents because we believe they are doing a very important job and taking care of these children.
We have a few minutes left. What's the process involved if I want to become an adoptive parent or a foster parent?
With the state, we have a training that we provide. It's free of charge. You come, you go through the training, you do some background checks, we get some references. The main requirements are to be age 21 or older. If you're married, we, of course, need verification of that, but single people can also apply. Throughout the training, we do home visits, we get credit references and different things. All of that is free of charge. We do all of it. The only cost to them is the gas to get wherever we're having the training. We typically do at least 4 or 5 trainings a year, usually between Mount Sterling, Flemingsburg, and some in Moorhead as well.
I imagine the experience is pretty rewarding, and I was going to ask you about perhaps more information. Where could that be accessed?
Absolutely. The experience of being a foster parent is very rewarding. I'm also one of the lucky ones that gets to see and attend adoption hearings when that gets to happen. And to be there with that family when they get to make things official, it's definitely a blessing for me. If they do want more information, they can contact me. Again, my name's Mandy Roberts. I work in the Menifee County office. That number there is 606-768-2154. Doesn't matter what county you're in, give me a call, and I'll be glad to talk with you and give you more information.
Mandy, thanks so much for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
And once again, that's Amanda Roberts, social service clinician for the state of Kentucky on Front Page. We'll have more in just a moment.
There are many ways to connect with Morehead State Public Radio. Log on to WMKY.org for enhanced regional news, on-demand audio and video, breaking news from NPR, and information on your favorite programs. Get links to Facebook and Twitter while you listen to our live broadcast online, or download mobile apps from NPR and take 90.3 FM with you everywhere. Connect with your community and Morehead State Public Radio. Visit WMKY.org.
Welcome back to Front Page. I'm Chuck Morales. We're talking now with Rowan County Chief Deputy Sheriff Joe Klein about Operation Rowan Roundup, the countywide drug sweep.
I know this is kind of an ongoing thing, and just kind of how are things going at this point?
Okay, it sounds good. Chuck, I'm glad you called. The Roundup's still going on. We're not doing the Roundup as far as numbers like we were one time. And that's because, of course, you know, every time we talk about House Bill 463, which is kind of, limits us on how we operate. But, it's minimized the drug loss to the point where you got to spend more money and you got to buy more to be able to keep them in the system or get them actually back in the system. But it's still going on. We're making, progress. We're making arrests. But there's still just a lot of drug activity going on.
I'll ask you this because you kind of brought this point up in the sense, you know, needing more money to do some of these buys so you can catch these people. I know we're talking about state budget cuts across the board. Will that impact you guys in any way with this?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's going to or how that's going to work. Anytime that there's cuts across the board, and state, it kind of has that ripple effect. We have been funded in the past through Operation Unite, and those funds have been cut, and we've been operating on, through asset forfeiture and through, the funds that we were able to set aside, from the office budget that we make every year. So, I mean, of course, when Unite funding stopped, that hurt us quite a bit as far as going out and being able to have money to spend on fighting this drug epidemic we're having.
How much did you take a cut in when you lost those Unite funds?
Well, they pretty much gave us, without doing a count, I'm just going off the top of my head, we had a amount that, a set amount we could use per week, and I think it ended up somewhere around $3,000 to $5,000, that we could use. And when I say a week, that was limit on the top end. That wasn't something, that we, got every week. We didn't use that. It's just that was the limit we could do without getting, upper level approval. But they pretty much gave us that ability to use that. And to go out and, if you're going to buy a pill on the street, it's $50 a pill. And, of course, it takes money to combat all that.
So at this point, what are you operating with and where's the money coming from?
Well, like I said, we've been able to budget some, and then some of us through our asset forfeiture program that we're part of the state and federal asset forfeiture program. And that's one way to be able to, we've talked about it for several years as to how you hurt the drug dealers and suppliers is, you go after their assets. And they've gotten a little smarter with that, too. But we've been able to do pretty well with it. And, it's just managing your money. And it's like, any household would do. You do what you do within the guidelines of your budget.
I know Governor Bevin has talked about, as he's taking office and getting more involved with it, that there's got to be something done regarding the drug problem in Kentucky. Are you hopeful that means perhaps spending more in this war on drugs?
I hope so. I haven't seen anything that the governor has put out there as far as helping us and law enforcement and combating the drug problem. But I'm all for anything that he can provide our way. If it's opening up a different office. Years ago it was DARE. The DARE program and things. After a while they kind of they're good for the time, and then now it's time to maybe open up another area of funding and call it something else. And of course we would welcome anything like that that would help us.
At this point, what are you dealing with for the most part? I think when this started it was pills, and in most recent years it's been heroin. Is it still heroin?
Yeah, it's both, really. It's both pills and heroin we're dealing with. And not a lot of it slowed down. It's a lot of activity going on, and we're just we're fighting it on all ends, within our means.
Is Detroit still, I guess, the hub of the operation for heroin that's running into Kentucky right now?
Say it again.
I was going to say, in the past, I think we talked, and Detroit was mainly the place where heroin was being pumped into Kentucky, and in particular eastern Kentucky and Rowan County. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's still one of the areas that we can see that it's coming from, but it's not just that area. There's other areas of the United States that we find that it's funneling through here, but Detroit's still is a pipeline.
What can you do about this? I mean, I know that every time you do something, I guess the drug dealers answer and they try to do something else to counter whatever mm-hmm. you're doing to combat this problem.
Well, just the chess match, we're trying to work, like I said, smarter and work within the guidelines of the law. That's the thing we have to do, which the drug dealers and suppliers and wholesalers don't do. We operate within the law and within our budget, and even with all the restraints and the guidelines, and we're still able to do something with it. I'm reluctant to say make a dent, or we're out here. They know we're out here actively doing this enforcement, and I think that's what's kept this area from just being overwhelmed. I don't think we're at the point where we're overwhelmed, but and enforcement does that, enforcement, and then the treatment process, and hopefully that somebody can get help with their addictions, because they know that this is a hub and there's a market here. That's the reason they just keep coming.
Yeah, and you mentioned making a dent in it. Do you feel like you've made progress here in the last 5 years?
In some areas we do, but it seems like the laws keep us on our toes to where we're all time having to change our methods and how we operate, the funding, and it's always a challenge. But it's like that in life, Chuck. Anything we do, we operate the best we can. We're doing the best we can with what we've got. We're taking complaints. We're answering those complaints. We're following up anyone that the citizens, and they've been tremendous about helping us and trying to follow up with them with any concerns they have. And we're just, I basically tell them what I've told you this morning. We're doing all we can do with the number of personnel we have and the money we've got to operate with.
We talked about needing the public's help when you started this whole operation several years ago, and since the time you started to the point we are now, are you seeing people more actively involved in trying to help you combat the drug problem?
Yes, yeah, we are. It's just like we get the tips, the crime tips, and the drug tips, and they do it anonymously. But what I'm feeling more is we're having a lot less anonymous tips, and people are saying, hey, this is so-and-so in my neighborhood's we think has got a drug dealer in it, or we've got drug dealers going, drug deals going on, and people are just getting tired seeing it and dealing with it, you know. And they're reporting it, and we're trying to do something about it.
You touched on House Bill 463, and we'll remind people, basically that's a bill that takes low-level drug offenders and diverts them through treatment instead of putting them into jail, people they don't feel are a real danger to society. Basically, they're selling to feed their habit, so to speak, or just buying drugs because they have a habit, but at the same time, it's created other issues, correct?
Correct. That's part of it, you know, and we're all for that part of it. But the other part of it is it takes more, you're just like the difference between a D felony and a C felony. We can arrest somebody on a Class D felony, and they're automatically eligible for parole or automatically eligible for bond. It's not like we can put them in and keep them in if they don't have a criminal history, if they don't have anything in their background. And that was a tool we were using. We could charge them with a felony. They could keep them in jail long enough to where they could find a treatment program for them and get them into treatment. Now, basically, is if we charge them with a Class D felony, they're basically released, you know, saying before we get our paperwork done.
So do you feel like they should be spending more time in jail? That would be a better deterrent than just, say, cutting some of these people loose, especially when you talk about a felony crime?
Jail is a deterrent. There's no doubt. No, you can take a poll up there to any of the jails or prisons, and nobody wants to be there. Jail is a deterrent, but that's not the total answer. You know, I think the combination of incarceration, because Chuck, you have to separate an addict from their substance of choice or their addiction of choice. You have to get that separation there to give them a time to at least let their mind clear out and let them think rationally about, hey, I need some help. If you put them in, they get right back out. There's no incentive for them to even think about, and they can't do it on their own because they're an addict. There's no incentive for them to even do it if there's no punishment for them doing what they're doing. Now, is it the answer? Absolutely not. I don't believe that incarceration is the answer, but I think it's part of the answer. It's part of doing what they need, and of course they don't like it, but it's part of separating them from their substance of choice.
Do you ever kind of feel like you and your officers are like that little boy who puts his finger in the dike to plug the leak, but you just don't have enough fingers right now?
Yeah, enough fingers or toes. That's exactly right.
So what's the next step, Joe, in your mind? What should be done here?
Well, I'm hoping, you know, we've got a new governor. He understands, you know, we've made it a point to get to the people that are close to him to be able to explain to him the problems and issues. And he says he does see that. And he sees that we have a need for maybe a different approach to enforcement. The enforcement's got to happen out here, and he knows that, and that's part of it. I'm hoping, you know, that there will be some funding. I don't know if it'll be this year or next with the budget cuts, but maybe they can channel it, you know, differently and do something.
Once again, that's Rowan County Chief Deputy Sheriff Joe Klein. I'm Chuck Mraz on Front Page. We'll see you next time.